I do think Ireland's going to blow. You can't keep on treating the people with the contempt that the establishment have been treating them with. It creates a vacuum, and into that vacuum come bad actors. Ireland has a brilliant opportunity to avoid all the mistakes that our European neighbours and our British neighbours made, because we see it happening and we know the steps that we can take. Will we take them? Will we buggery? We will just continue to blindly go down the same line, and then when streets on Dublin are on fire, the establishment will look around and go, how did that happen? And I'll tell you how it happened. You didn't listen to the people, and you were too full of contempt for the working class who were raising these objections for years.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Ian O'Doherty. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you on. I've wanted you on for some time to talk about things that are happening in Ireland, where you are, of course, an esteemed, if occasionally controversial, observer of Irish affairs and Irish life. And I particularly wanted you on to talk about some of the disturbances that have been taking place in Ireland over the past few months, and more than a few months, especially in relation to immigration, the immigration question and so on. And lo and behold, the week in which we're speaking, that kind of thing is happening on steroids here in Britain. Everyone around the world will have seen the riots that have rocked our towns and cities following the stabbing of three girls in Southport recently. So I guess I want to kick off by asking you how this riotous event has landed in Ireland. What is the Irish media making of it? What are Irish people making of it? What are they thinking about Britain as they look at all this stuff?
Well, this has played straight into the hands of an awful lot of the Irish media, who might try to pretend otherwise, but they really just don't like the English. And they really, really don't like the English working class. Brexit, in many ways, gave these people, who are middle-class clowns, by the way, license to unleash the last acceptable racism in Ireland, which is anti-English racism. Oh, and anti-Semitism, of course, which we have always specialised in. That's one of our national traits. But there's been a sense of almost glee amongst the chattering classes, amongst the Irish political elites and media and academia and stuff like that. And they somehow are trying to spin this as if they have been proved right. Because what they've been saying is, you see, we told you that if you voted for Brexit, you're going to become a fascist hellhole. And that, you know, people of colour wouldn't be safe, and this was inevitable. In many ways, the Irish Times is like The Guardian. And RTE is like the BBC. I mean, they're almost interchangeable. And really what this boils down to is a class contempt. It's a contempt towards the working class. They don't trust them. They don't know them. They don't like them. And they don't respect them. And the biggest hotspot in Ireland when it comes to issues about immigration has been a very deprived area of Dublin called Coolock, which used to have several main local employers, which kept everybody going. Crown Paints being one of the main ones. And now Crown Paints has been gone for the last few years. The area has fallen into serious decline. And the government decided in their infinite wisdom that they were going to turn the factory into another asylum hotel, which was really adding insult to injury to a bunch of people who already feel neglected and marginalised. And then the media and the politicians express absolute outrage. Again, very similar to Starmer. They express outrage and surprise when the locals are incensed. And then when outsiders who have more sinister intent come in and try to exploit that. What's interesting to remember about Coolock, when it was all this thing of, oh, it's the far right. The far right's irrelevant in Ireland. Thugs aren't. As we saw in the riots in November, and four people have been charged and prosecuted over it. They weren't charged for hate speech. They were charged for looting. And the interesting thing to remember about the riots in Dublin in November on O'Connell Street was that of all the looting that was done, it was places like Foot Locker, whereas Eason's, which is one of the biggest bookstores in Ireland, they weren't looted. You know, it was people looking for cheap runners. And to get back to what we're seeing in England, I find it baffling. I mean, the last few times I've been over to England, has been going over to see Oldham play football, and you don't get much more working class than Oldham, and I love it. And I much prefer the north of England to, say, London, for example. As an Irish person, I feel very comfortable in the north of England. I think they're very similar to us. And what I'm seeing is just a primal howl of rage that's coming from people who are now into their second or third generation of not just being ignored, but being reviled and insulted. And ultimately, it's the old truism that if you give a dog a bad name, you know, if you keep on telling people that they're far right, when all they want to do is make sure that their kids have a school to go to, when all they want to do is to try and keep some sort of community cohesion together. Labour, which was set up to look after the interests of the working class, that's its whole raison d'etre. The same as the Labour Party in Ireland was set up to look after the interests of the working class. And the Labour Party in Ireland and the Labour Party in England, they're now become a managerial class and an academia class. They don't care about the working class. The working class are gone, even though the working class are the foundation stones of both Labour parties in the UK and Ireland. And when we saw the riots in Hare Hills, you had Labour coming out saying that we will listen to the concerns of the community. When we see riots amongst the Muslim community, it's, well, because they've been insulted and they shouldn't have been insulted, or because, you know, it's racist, blah, blah, blah. When we see riots coming from the white community, from the working class community, it's because they're fascists and they're Nazis. Nobody's talking about listening to their concerns because nobody cares about their concerns. You know, and you have Yvette Cooper coming out and to placate the Roma rioters, the Hare Hills rioters. You have her coming out and trying to placate Muslims. We saw some of the violence in Birmingham. I mean, they went off on them, you know, and they were threatening journalists live on Sky. And it was interesting to see, you know, when the different protesters were facing off. Why are the Muslim protesters, when it comes down to rioting in Britain, they're all waving Palestinian flags? That's an issue that's 3,000 miles away. It has nothing to do with them. And we're seeing the same thing in Ireland. The thing is, I've always said that, obviously, I wanted independence, but I would have stayed in the Commonwealth because we're joined at the hip. And that's for better and for worse. And what we're seeing at the moment, politically, the similarities are both startling and quite depressing. Now, I've always felt like an outlier in Irish journalism. I didn't go to college. I started as a tea boy in Hot Press magazine when I was about 16. And I kind of gradually learned my trade. And that's one of the things as well, the difference I find with an awful lot of journalists now is they refer to it as their profession. I call it my trade because as far as I'm concerned, I'm a tradesman. And, you know, I learned it the hard way. Ireland's a small country. Dublin's a small town. And the Dublin journalistic community is even smaller. And most of them have all gone to the same college. A lot of them will have been in the same class. Most of them will have had the same lecturers. And most of those lecturers who I know are only lecturing because they couldn't cut it in a newsroom. And they're all very left-wing. Well, left-wing in the new definition, I should say. You know, they're very progressive. And, I mean, there was one guy who, he's now a lecturer. And I got an email a couple of years ago from a kid who just started in his first year in journalism. And he was asked, all the students are asked, who do you read? You know, what do you like? And this kid said, oh, I like your man Ian O'Doherty in the Indo. And the lecturer said, if you mention that man's name again, I'm going to fail you. So the kid got in touch with me and he said, what should I do? And I said, don't mention my name. You know, just don't, you know, because I know the guy involved. And he was a terrible downtable sub in the newsroom. And he just couldn't cut it. And they got rid of him. So it was the living embodiment of that old cliche that those who can do and those who can't teach. We can kind of laugh about these ridiculous kind of anecdotes or whatever, but this is what's creating a generation of Borg-like journalists who, they like to sneer at religion because that's the trendy thing to do in Ireland now. You're not just non-Catholic, you're anti-Catholic, and Catholicism represents everything that's regressive and nasty and stuff like that. But they cling to their articles of faith just as stubbornly as the old school Catholics clung to their catechism. And they don't seem to realise that they have simply swapped one religion for another. There's a few of them, particularly in the Irish Times. And I made a point about one of them a while ago that she's a particular scold. And she just loves scolding people. I've often said about her that 30 or 40 years ago, she would have been a nun. Because she's fulfilling the same need in her psyche to give out to people and to sneer at people. And this is something that you see a lot when you read The Guardian. You see a lot when you read a lot of the Irish media. And again, it goes back to the fact that if you look at the areas that are most impacted by immigration in the UK, they're working class areas. If you look at the areas that are most affected by immigration in Ireland, they're working class or rural areas. None of the journalists and none of the politicians live in these areas. Like, the only time they see Coolock is when they're on their way out to the airport to go off on some nice junket. The only working class person they meet is the cleaner who comes around to their house twice a week, right? And so for them, immigration is a nice theoretical notion that we should all be lovely to everybody. They're not moving international protection camps into Donnybrook or Sandymount or Ranelagh or Dalkey, which are the very leafy suburbs where a lot of the journalists happen to live. And I can guarantee you, if they did, a lot of these journalists would suddenly go through the moral contortions that we're so used to seeing them about why they'd be putting in planning objections. As far as they're concerned, the working class can go to hell. It's as simple as that.
It's very useful to hear you describe it like that, especially when you talk about the relish or the glee with which the chattering classes in the Irish media looked at the riots in Britain, because we've had an element of that even from our own native ruling class here in the UK. Of course, they're horrified by the riots, and of course, they've devoted a huge amount of energy to crushing them in terms of police time and so on. But there is also an extraordinary level of moral opportunism, I think, amongst the establishment, who see this almost not in any even particularly conscious way, but they definitely see this explosion of violence as a way of further consolidating their moral authority. So this is another way in which they can write off every complaint about immigration or the lack of debate about immigration as just fascism. This is another way in which they can further stamp their authority on white working class communities in particular. They see in this unrest a way of consolidating their power. And that's what I find really depressing about the riots in the UK, because what is happening in the discussion about them is that everything is being collapsed together. So the extraordinary violence that we've seen, where mosques have been attacked and hotels have been attacked and real horrific violence has been carried out by thugs, as you described the blokes in Dublin who rioted last November. Real shocking violence has been carried out by thugs, utterly worthy of condemnation and punishment. But that's then collapsed together with the entire community in which these thugs are operating, as if all of them are borderline fascist, all of them are racist, every complaint they raise probably has its origins in xenophobia. So there's this kind of conflation of everything as a consequence of these riots. And I wanted to ask you if a similar dynamic happened in Ireland after the riots in November. So what's really striking about the riots that you had on O'Connell Street in Dublin, where you say Foot Locker was looted but Easons wasn't. I love Easons on O'Connell Street, by the way. It's a great shop. I'm glad it wasn't looted or burnt down. What's really interesting is that the trigger for that was the stabbing of three girls, and then a lot of discussion amongst ordinary people about who did this, why are we not being told the truth, and so on. And the trigger for the riots in the UK, of course, was the stabbing of more than three girls, but three of them died as a consequence of their injuries. So it's very interesting. There are commonalities between them. But I wanted to ask you, what was the response from the Irish establishment to those November riots? Did they do what the establishment here is currently doing, which is just to write them off as far-right, racist, and use them as an opportunity to demonise all complaints about immigration as being somehow problematic?
Honestly, it's as if Keir Starmer is following the template that had been established by the Irish government in the wake of the November riots. Micheál Martin came out and he was talking about immediately the far right. Without barely pausing for breath, he immediately started banging on about the importance of bringing in really strict hate speech laws, which I've written about for Spiked, which would make Scotland's hate speech laws look like a libertarian paradise. And again, it's the cynicism of it. In the same way that I honestly think the UK government are absolutely delighted about the riots, because it gets them off the hook. And in the same way that anybody in America who tries to defend Trump, immediately they have January 6th just shouted at them, as if that's it. That's the silver bullet that kills all debate and all argument. And what we saw in November was an explosion of criminality that we really haven't seen in Dublin for generations. The massive overreaction and hysteria was incredible, and it just goes to show how quickly the thin veneer of civil behaviour from the elites drops, and they showed their true colours. You know, I mean, all they were sure to do was talking about internment of everybody who lived in Sheriff Street and the area around them, because they're just the wrong type of people and you can't trust them. There was one councillor down in Limerick who said that the rioters should have been shot in the head. And he's still a councillor. Like, I often think that I've just wandered into somebody else's nightmare, where common sense just seems to have gone out the window. Like, we live in a world where liberal values are now held up and accused of being conservative values. Free speech, freedom of assembly, you know, general tolerance. And what used to be seen as very regressive, nasty kind of principles, they're now the principles of the progressives. I started out in journalism when I was very young. It was the only thing I can do. A lot of people say I still can't do it, but I'm doing my best, right? And back then, the enemy was the church, because the church was the dominant influence in Ireland. And I remember taking great pride when there'd be angry phone calls from priests or angry letters from bishops. Bishops don't make phone calls. That's beneath them. They get their secretary to write a letter. And I remember there'd be older journalists and they'd be freaking out and they'd be going, Bishop such and such is on the warpath about something you wrote. And I'd laugh and I go, good, because I always thought it's the job of a journalist to really piss these people off. It's both a privilege and a responsibility to give the two fingers to the people who are the dominant social force. Now, I've kind of flipped on that, because the Catholic Church as an institution is so irrelevant in this country that I actually kind of feel sorry for them now. And I think the best form of rebellion a young person could do in Ireland would be to go to Mass, because everybody sneers at them. And there were journalists who are sneering at them now who were very quick to bend the knee when it suited them, right? So the church now is kind of irrelevant, and it has been for a very long time. The church has been replaced by a new clerisy, which is the politicians and the journalists and the academics and the NGOs. The NGOs get away with murder, and we're paying for these NGOs. When I'm talking about the topsy-turvy thing, we have like the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. Now, when we hear the phrase civil liberties, you go, okay, we're all for civil liberties. They're demanding the introduction of the incredibly stringent hate speech laws. So that doesn't sound very civil libertarian to me. And you journalists demanding the introduction of hate speech laws, you know, or journalists for censorship, as I call them. And you can see the disconnect that's going on. A lot of it is cowardice, and a lot of it is laziness. A very small proportion of it is genuine activism. Most of it is just going with the flow. And I remember my sort of intellectual divorce from Irish journalism, because I've always been proud to be a journalist. I think it's a proud trade. Being a journalist wasn't what I did, it was who I was. And I don't feel that anymore. Now it's just what I do. And a lot of that goes back to our response to Charlie Hebdo. And I remember being in conference around the time of the Charlie Hebdo thing, and I was saying, run the pictures. Run the pictures. We need to run the pictures. They've just killed 12 of us. How would we feel if somebody had come into our office on Talbot Street and sprayed the newsroom? We need to run the pictures. And of course they wouldn't. And I was looked at like I was a lunatic. We have quite a rump of Islamic fundamentalism in Ireland. And I've had a couple of death threats. I've had the cops come around to the office and say, you can't come in here anymore. Although my favourite death threat was one of them who actually rang up to apologise in advance, because he was going to be standing outside the building with a gun and a bottle of acid. If anybody else got injured, he just wanted to know that it was only me that he was going after. And I thought, what a very polite person to make a death threat. So I don't take any of these things seriously, but they are there. What was incredible was that the paper that I worked for, all the journalists got together and they did a big picture, and they're all holding up the placards saying, you know, Je suis Charlie. And I refused to take part in it. I just walked off. I just went off for a beer. Because it was like, if you won't run the pictures, you are not Charlie. And you see, the thing is as well, is that we're all aware that we're working in a dying trade. Print journalism it's got a couple of years left at best. So On the older side of the thing, a lot of the commissioning editors and stuff, they're just hanging on to try and get to retirement. People tend to forget about the power of human nature. These things aren't great conspiracies. They're not great trends. It's basically people just trying to get through the day. And we tend to forget about that. And I know a lot of people in their sort of late 50s, early 60s, who are in good positions. They just want to get to retirement and then they want to get out. So they're not going to have a row with Muslims. They're not going to have a row with the trans brigade. They don't want any hassle. So for people like me who kind of thrive on the hassle, because I like a good scrap with these people, we become pushed further and further out of the main part of the paper. We work in a more conservative media now, a more cowed media. There's lots of really good, frustrated people in it. And there's a lot of really bad people in it who consider themselves to be activists or part of the establishment. There's one fascinating case that what I'm thinking about. 2 years ago, there was an Irish nurse called Ashley Murphy, who was murdered in broad daylight by a guy called Joseph Pushka, who was a Slovakian immigrant who'd been here with his family for 10 years. He hadn't worked in 7. He was also a convicted sex criminal in Slovakia. He was a person of interest in sex offences in the Czech Republic and the United Kingdom. The case absolutely shocked the country. A young girl in broad daylight, you know, this doesn't happen in Ireland, you know. Her fiance, he wrote a very eloquent victim impact statement, which moved everybody to tears. It was just, the grief was just there. It was like he wrote it in his own blood, from his own heart. And he was saying that Ireland has lost its innocence and that Puska had never given anything back to this country. He'd only ever taken it from the time he was here. And Ryan wanted to get back to an Ireland where everybody, regardless of where they were from, could walk down the street during the day without worrying about one of these animals coming along and killing them. All of that part of the victim impact statement was redacted by a lot of the Irish newspapers. And one journalist from the Irish Times went on to the BBC, BBC Northern Ireland, and she said that the Irish Times were right to not include that portion of the victim impact statement because A, it was incitement to hatred, B, it wasn't helpful, and C, Ryan had become a hero of the far right. And then she also pointed out that Puska's nationality was irrelevant, despite the fact that he was a convicted sex offender in his native country. I think that makes it fairly bloody relevant. One of the things I thought was most interesting about that was that when, it was this one, Kitty Holland, just think Owen Jones in a bad wig, right? That's what we're dealing with, right? She's a Nepo baby. She's Eamon McCann and Mary Holland's child, two sort of firebrand Irish journalists. And when she said it wasn't helpful, Mark Carruthers, who was the presenter, didn't pull her back and say, helpful to whom? It wasn't helpful to the government strategy? It wasn't helpful to the Irish Times editorial policy? Who was it not helpful to? I remember watching it at the time going, this is going to cause war. It was the sheer hubris and this sort of smug arrogance of, well, his statement wasn't helpful. Well, his fiance, who he was due to get married, had just been slaughtered in broad daylight on a street. I'd say his victim impact statement was helpful to him, and he's the only person who counts. Again, the article of faith that I mentioned earlier. You know, Holland's article of faith is that immigration is great, multiculturalism is great, and if you dare to question any of these articles of faith, well then, you're a heretic, and you must go through all the punishments that Christian heretics have to go through. At every point, when you go through the progressive movement, who aren't very progressive at all, you can see it's a new religion. And it's that old line that when people stop believing in religion, it's not that they believe in nothing, it's that they believe in anything. It's that they have this burning desire to cling to a dogma. That means they don't really have to interrogate the issues for themselves. They have their high priests and their high priestesses, they have their Fintan O'Toole's, they have their Kitty Hollands, and they will do the thinking, such as it is, for them. I mean, Irish Twitter is insane. It's absolutely deranged. Most people I know, normal people, have just left because it's been taken over by mentally ill men in frocks. You'd swear Graham Linehan was worse than Hitler. Now, and I have to say, I mean, what happened to Graham was a disgrace, but predictable. What happened to Graham from Graham's friends was a disgrace, but wasn't as predictable. And I know, Graham, we worked in Hot Press when we were teenagers together. And here's the thing, we've never liked each other. I don't like Graham. Graham doesn't like me. Yet, I found myself being the only person who was defending Graham on radio and in print. Because the fact that me and Graham don't like each other is entirely irrelevant, because it's the principle, not the person. And we have a similar social circle in Dublin. You know, again, small town, we all work together. You know, it's comedians and journalists and, you know, musicians and tossers, basically. But people who've been really, really close to Graham, and people who were happy to bathe in his reflected glory when he was winning BAFTAs and winning all the awards and stuff, and they were very happy to let it be known that they were friends of Graham's, they ran a mile. And again, it shows the kind of topsy-turvy world we live in, that the only person really who was defending Graham in Ireland is a bloke who can't stand him.
I really want to ask you about this new religion that you've mentioned there. So the guy you've talked about is Ryan Casey, who was, as you say, the fiancé of Aisling Murphy, who was killed in Tullamore near Offaly in 2022. And I mean, that made waves not only in Ireland, but around the world. And there was a vigil for her in London as well. And I was really shocked by the redacting of some of what Ryan Casey said. It was incredibly disturbing. But what was really interesting to me about the Aisling Murphy case, firstly, the horror of it, of course, but also very early on, after the terrible event itself, there was already a bubbling discussion about the problem of misogynistic violence, the problem of male behaviour. There was already this desire amongst the establishment, the cultural establishment, to broaden this one event out into a condemnation of male behaviour more broadly. But as soon as it became clear that the suspect was an immigrant, that instantly complicated their narrative. And then their instinct was not to broaden it out, not to say that this tells us a bigger story about certain groups of people, but rather to do the precise opposite and to say that this has, you know, no reflection whatsoever on any group of people. And anyone who says otherwise, including even the grieving fiance of Aisling Murphy, is a problem. So that was such a striking case in terms of the hypocrisy, the double standards, and the authoritarianism of that section of the chattering class. And it spoke to an issue that you've raised a couple of times, and I really wanted to ask you about this, which is the replacement of Ireland's old religion with a new religion. So Catholicism is out. I go to Mass when I'm in Ireland with my family, and there's not many people there. And it really has died a death in some ways. And the Catholic Church has become the butt of every joke and the target of every woke attack, socially aware attack. People just love making fun of the Catholic Church. But at the exact same time, a new religion has crept in, the religion of wokeness, or however else we want to describe it. And it's amazing how many ideals of this new religion are similar to the ideals of the old religion. So firstly, there's the censorious approach, the crushing of anyone who dares to blaspheme or dissent. There's the rather neglectful attitude to women. We know that the Catholic Church did not have a perfect approach to women, and we know that wokeness doesn't either. The way in which it allows men to parade around in women-only spaces, or to invade women's sports, or even to be imprisoned in women's prisons, as we saw with Barbie Kardashian in Limerick. And it also has undertones of anti-Semitism, which you've mentioned before. You know, the Catholic Church had its problem with Jewish people, and this new religion has its problem with Jewish people too. So the commonalities between the two religions I find very interesting. How is it possible that you can have this media elite based in Dublin, which considers itself very free-thinking and open-minded in comparison with the cultures around the country and the kind of ignorant rural people, which is how it tends to view them? It thinks of itself as very open-minded and very liberal and very right on, but it actually, they have become adherents to this new religion. How do you explain that contradictory dynamic?
I think the templates might change, but human nature doesn't. And the labels might change, but human nature doesn't. So the same kind of people who would have gravitated towards the church when the church held the whip hand over the Irish are now gravitating towards what, you know, we might loosely define as sort of a woke culture. But even when you're talking about the censoriousness of the current iteration that we're seeing at the moment. The great Edna O'Brien recently died, quite simply one of the greatest novelists in the history of the English language. And she had her books burnt, literally books burnt. It was amazing to see all of these people when they were doing the appraisals of O'Brien's life, and they were quite rightly condemning the Catholic Ireland that she escaped from. They were quite rightly condemning that whole attitude. These are the same people who launched campaigns against John Boyne, the author, for daring to write about trans issues. And they don't see the irony. A lot of these people, they're actually quite dim. There's no level of self-reflection. There's no level of saying Edna O'Brien was brilliant and she was persecuted by an intolerant, censorious regime. Now let's go and burn Graham Linehan's book in the name of kindness. One of the most liberal people I know in terms of he can have a reasonable debate and without losing his marbles is a guy called David Quinn, who works for a Catholic foundation called the Iona Institute. He's a fairly hardcore Catholic, but he doesn't care really what other people get up to. Now, abortion is a red line for him, as it is for a lot of people, as it is for quite a few atheists as well. You know, abortion isn't just a religious issue. We have this idea over here that anybody who's against abortion must be a religious fanatic. Yet, even though myself and David, we disagree on euthanasia, we disagree on various different issues, we'll meet up for a beer every now and then, and we'll have a laugh. And we'll do what everybody used to do back in the before times, before Brexit, before Trump, where people who disagree get together, have a few beers, have a laugh. And with me and David, we have about a half an hour of trashing out the various different, you know, moral issues of the day. And then we talk about football. And then we just go home. Whereas when you're talking about the censorious attitude that come in, I've lost friends because of Brexit and Trump. Now, 10 years ago, I would have thought such a thing. These are people I've known for 20 odd years and people I've worked with for a long time. I've been to their weddings. They've been to mine. I've been to their kids' communions and christenings. You know, they've been to my house. I've been to theirs. A couple of them, we'd even been on holidays together. And it just seemed at some point, about 8 years ago, people lost their marbles and they completely lost the ability to disagree, respectfully or not respectfully. I think respectful disagreement is often overrated. The holy trinity that's guaranteed to break friendships these days are Trump, Brexit and Israel. And a very quick example of that, there's a friend of mine. I was the first person that he came out to as a gay person. And we were in a club and he said, listen, can I have a word with you? And I went, yeah, what? He said, look, you know, I want you to know I'm gay. And I went, yeah, I know, and it's your round. Everybody knew, you know, but he's ferociously anti-Israel to the point of open anti-Semitism. The last conversation I had with him, he'd ring and he'd just try and annoy me about Israel. And I said, look, if you and Richard's his boyfriend, I said, if you and Richard go to Gaza tomorrow, you'd be swinging from a lamppost or you'd be thrown from the tallest building by sundown. I guarantee you that. It's part of the Hamas charter. They will not suffer a sodomite to live. Whereas if you go to Tel Aviv, and of course he'd never been to Israel. I've been to Israel many times. I love the place. Of course, if you go to Tel Aviv is pretty much the gayest city outside of America. And you get on great. And I said, by the way, Eugene, Israeli guys are really good looking. You'd have a ball. And he said, well, maybe, but at least the Palestinians are decent people, unlike those effing Jews. And the mask slipped. And what we've seen since October the 7th is they don't even bother keeping on the mask anymore. They don't bother. And it was terrible. I went to the Israeli Independence Day. Normally, it's a very good party. And this year was a very somber one. And they had to have it in the synagogue, which fortunately is just around the corner from me. But they had to have it in the synagogue because they didn't feel safe having it in a hotel. And one of the things that really struck me as myself and my wife walked through was just how old most of the people were. And I was talking to Tommy Riekenthal, who's a Holocaust survivor. He wrote a brilliant book, I Was a Boy in Belsen. So he went through Belsen, he went through all the horrors, and he's still kind of broken by it, and he's in his 80s. But his wife, who's a wonderful woman, she just turned around to me and she said, it's happening again. When these people say it, listen, they know what they're talking about. They've been through it before. And we used to have a Catholic religious-based anti-Semitism because they killed Christ. You know, we had the pogrom down in Limerick in 1908 and stuff like that. The area where I live in Dublin now, called Terenure, that used to be known as Jewtown when I was growing up. And it wasn't known as Jewtown in an affectionate way, I can assure you. right? But that was a vestigial religious dislike. Now that we've got rid of traditional religion, now it's more of a political and a secular dislike. But really, it's just an excuse. It's just an excuse for my gay friend to say that he would prefer the people who would kill him than the people who would give him a gay pride march. On what planet? You know, the Hamas and Hezbollah leaders who were killed by Israel, right? Bloody good operations, and Israeli intelligence needed a win after October the 7th, and they kind of got to a degree with that. There was a vigil outside the GPO in Dublin's O'Connell Street in memory of two martyrs of the resistance. I couldn't believe it. These people are terrorists. They're genocidal maniacs. And there was a vigil for the heroes of the resistance. Around the corner from my house, there's a house with a bunch of Palestinian flags flying out the window. Now, that's fine. If that's what they want to do, you know, let them do it. I've no problem with that. But I can guarantee you, if I put an Israeli flag outside my window, I give it 5 minutes before the window's gone. The Jewish community in Dublin has contributed a huge amount to this city and to this country, in politics, in law, and people who used to have to keep their dislike kind of hidden, they've now been given moral license to release the hounds of their hatred. And we're going back into the blood libel again, that, you know, Jews are baby killers. And I've tried to argue this on News Talk, which is the only radio station that will kind of give me any sort of a platform at the moment. And I've tried to point out the facts. Hamas are hiding behind the kids. Every dead child is a PR victory for Hamas because it's on the front page of every Western paper. And they just don't listen. And again, it goes back to my old Catholic friend, David Quinn. It'd be like me trying to tell him that transubstantiation isn't real. He knows it's not real, but he's never going to admit it because it's an article of faith. And so it's the same. I always think it's an interesting link between transubstantiation and transgender. Both are things that don't exist. Trans just means not. So when you see trans man, it just means not man. When you see trans woman, it just means not a woman. We're going through an age of extreme religious fervor, except it's coming under a different label. The impact is the same, and it's vicious and extremely intolerant. I just long for a return to common sense. I long for a day when I can have an argument with my friends without everybody blocking each other on their phones. My only paranoid conspiracy theory is that I'm convinced that TikTok is a Chinese invention to rot the West from the inside out. When you saw all the young kids converting to Islam when Bin Laden's letter to America was released on TikTok, we seem to be becoming a more stupid culture, a more gullible culture. You know, we have all of the world's libraries at our fingertips in our phone. We should be entering an age of intellectual and moral enlightenment. All the great ideas are there. Every aspect that lifts us up from the animals is there. And yet we're devolving. Like, it terrifies me.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, get a discount on all items in our shop, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. I often think, yes, I mean, social media has so clearly molded itself around a culture of dumbing down, moral relativism, outright stupidity, censoriousness, all those other problems that have been gathering pace for some time in our societies. I often think to myself, I'd love to be able to blame China for this, but I actually think we did it to ourselves. This is an internal decay of Western society of historic proportions and one that really needs to be reckoned with. You mentioned there the anti-Israel sentiment in Ireland, which very often, I think, crosses the line into anti-Semitism. And I did want to ask you about that, actually, because there does seem to be a specific issue in Ireland. I mean, anti-Semitism is a problem right now across the whole of Europe. We've seen a lot of it in the UK. And in fact, one of the striking things about our current riotous moment is that people are up in arms about the mobs attacking mosques. And I think they are absolutely right to be up in arms about that. My view is that you should never attack a person's place of worship. It's irrational and stupid and destructive and very often bigoted. But these same people said nothing when synagogues were under attack over the past 9 months since the 7th of October pogrom. And in Britain, we've seen synagogues being coated with racist graffiti. At one synagogue, a pro-Palestine mob turned up and the worshippers had to be spirited out by literal police officers. A man was recently sentenced to jail for 8 years in Britain for plotting to bomb a synagogue. So very serious levels of violent threat and violent assault on synagogues. And all these people currently writing their columns or sending their tweets about the horror of mobs attacking mosques said nothing whatsoever. Because in my view, they are not anti-racists at all. They are identitarian supremacists. Their interest is in working out which identity group deserves their sympathy and which does not. And the Jews do not. But in relation to Ireland, one question I get all the time from people who read my stuff or follow my stuff online, because I have a very Irish name, I obviously come from Ireland, people will often say to me, why is Ireland so fucked up on the Israel question? What is it about Ireland in particular? And I always say, well, it was Catholic for a long time, and now that's mingling with this wokeness thing. And it never feels like a satisfactory answer. Although I'm sure there's an element of that in relation to what's happening in Ireland. But why do you think, especially amongst the chattering classes in Ireland, there is this visceral contempt for the Jewish state, which sometimes becomes a contempt for the Jewish people? What's going on with that bigotry in particular?
I often think part of it is to do with envy. The Jews have, by number, become disproportionately successful because they value education and hard work. That's historically because they weren't allowed to do certain jobs. The Jewish schools in Dublin, I mean, they tend to do really well in the Leaving Cert and in academic exams and stuff like that. So that fits into this sort of reptilian suspicion of the other. And I was guilty of that myself. There's a friend of mine, Jewish guy, and Ireland were playing Israel in a European Euros qualifier. And this has gone back about 20 years. And I really put my foot in it because he was working for the Israeli embassy and things like that. And his sister, most of his family had moved over there. And I asked him, in ignorance rather than innocence, I said, who are you going to be supporting on Saturday, Ireland or Israel? And I will never forget the look of hurt on his face. And I couldn't apologise enough. And I still wince when I think about that. And as I said, I mean, I didn't mean it in any way maliciously. And he kind of brushed it off. But that must have given him the impression that really I didn't consider him to be as Irish as I was. I've made many stupid, past remarkable comments down the years that I regret. That's actually probably the one I regret the most, because it's the one that I worry does the most damage to the person that I'd said it to. Because it reinforced, even though I'd be a friend to the Israeli embassy, you know, I'd go out for lunch with the diplomats and stuff like that, and I go to Israel every chance I get, and I'm one of the few staunch defenders of Israel and Jews in the Irish media. But on that particular instance, I really dropped the ball, and I've always felt very guilty with that. But in terms of the current obsessive hatred, now it's obsessive. This goes back into laziness for a start. You'll be invited to the right dinner parties in the right circles if you say the right things. And it's like what I was saying at the top of the show, that in the way that an anti-English racism is the last acceptable racism in Ireland, apart from anti-Semitism. So if you say the right things, that they're slaughtering children, if you basically unwittingly parrot ancient blood libels without even realizing it. If you say from the river to the sea without even knowing which river and which sea, that doesn't matter. You're still saying the right thing. How many of the people, how many of those idiots turned up at the vigil for those two terrorists on Saturday and had no idea about how many innocent Jews that these people have killed? And not only would they have had no idea, they probably wouldn't care. And also, though, on a broader picture, anti-Semitism across the West, and I mean, in Australia, it's off the charts. In America now, they're openly calling for another Holocaust, you know? And that's coming from academia. It's not coming from rednecks. But this is a reminder that we often make the mistake of assuming that politics is linear, that the far right go one direction and the far left go the other direction. They're like train tracks. They'll never meet. But actually, politics is circular. And it's like having two hands and a clock that go in different directions. But sooner or later, they're going to meet. And where they meet is the Jews. Where the far left and the far right meet is their mutual hatred for the Jews. And I look around Dublin, which was once a very friendly town to Jews, with a good community. Even where I live, used to have a very strong Jewish population. Most of them have left. They've gone to Manchester or they've gone to Israel because they know that there's no future here for them. And I'm seeing with my own eyes an area that used to have a very strong Jewish presence no longer has a very strong Jewish presence. But I have Jewish friends and they go, where do I go? They don't feel safe in Israel. I have friends over there who are sleeping in safe rooms every night, right? They used to go to Manchester. They don't necessarily feel safe in Manchester. Certainly don't feel safe in London. America and Canada, they've gone crazy. And I do worry that we're on the cusp of some sort of Kristallnacht and the chattering classes will excuse it. That's the fear. And it seems that basically you can say what you like as long as it's about the Jews. And this thing, oh, there's a difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. That's bollocks, right? It's a distinction without a difference. They can try and dress it up as much as they want, but we know what it is. When somebody tells you what they think, you'd be better off believing in them and taking them at their word.
I really agree that the kind of common prejudice between the far right and the far left is the Jews. And in fact, over the past few days here in Britain, there have been two episodes of Nazi salutes being captured on camera. One of them was by a couple of the pricks taking part in the horrible riots that we've seen in the post-Southport moment. Two young white fellas with the England flag doing Nazi salutes. And I always think how ridiculous it is to have the England flag while saluting a racist ideology from Germany that we helped to defeat. But then the other image was from a pro-Palestine demonstration in London where a man did a Nazi salute to a group of Jews. So a group of Jews were counter-protesting and they were waving their Israeli flags and they were standing up for Israel. And this guy stood in front of them and did a Nazi salute. And you can guess which one caused a storm in the media. You can guess which one Keir Starmer openly condemned in one of his press conferences. It was, of course, the one done by the far-right idiots. And not the one done by the supposedly pro-Palestine activists. So there is this commonality between these two groups. But then, as you say, there is this excuse making by the chattering classes where only one form of far-right fascistic bigotry is condemned, while the other form is either ignored or, even worse, people apologize for it and say, well, they're angry about Israel, they're angry about this, they're angry about that. So it's a very dangerous, volatile situation, I think. Okay, Ian, my last question for you is on something you've touched on a few times in this conversation, which is freedom of speech, which is an issue close to my heart. I know it's an issue close to your heart as well. You've written about it for Spike. You've written about it elsewhere. You've mentioned already the hate speech law in Ireland, which people around the world are horrified about, including Elon Musk, who kicked up a fuss about it online. Tell us a little bit about where that is at the moment. How does it stand? Has there been any more pushback against it in Irish society, or did the recent riots and disturbances in Dublin convince the chattering classes even more so that they need to control how people think and what people say? What's the culture around freedom of speech in Ireland right now?
Well, the culture traditionally around freedom of speech in Ireland has never been particularly strong. You look at our libel and defamation laws, I mean, they're just off the charts. And again, that comes because we've always been a subjugated people, whether it was the church or whether it was the British or now whether it's the EU. The greatest myth the Irish have ever sold to the rest of the world is this idea of the fighting Irish. We're not fighters at all. We prefer somebody else to do the thinking for us. So people don't trust free speech. I mean, it's amazing how you see, you know, the really obnoxious phrase, freeze peach, that liberals use to mock the idea of free speech. And there's an Irish online publication called The Journal, and they said that free speech is cherished by conservatives and members of the far right. And you're going, like, the whole concept of free speech, modern free speech, comes from Berkeley in the 60s, which was a left-wing movement. There was a rally against the Criminal Justice Incitement to Hatred Act, or Hatred Bill. It hasn't been enacted yet. I'll get into that in a minute. There was a rally outside the Dáil, and I was asked to speak at it. I wasn't going to because I wasn't too sure about some of the other people around the panel. But then Antifa started making threats, and they said that they were going to wreck the place. So I said, okay, sign me up. I'll go. And what I thought was hilarious was, so we're all standing outside the Dáil. There's a line of police going down the middle of the street. The Antifa goons are on the other side, and they're all wearing balaclavas, and they're all shouting and stuff. And they all look very deeply unhappy. I mean, you never see a happy Antifa person. They all look like they need a good meal and a shag. But the point that I was making at that rally, and the point that I've made, is that I'm not looking to defend your right to free speech, Brennan. I'm not looking to defend my right to free speech. I'm looking to defend Antifa's right to free speech. I'm looking to defend the right of free speech for the people that I most disagree with. Because if you only defend the things you agree with, well, then you're not really defending anything. And there was a piece that I did for you guys with the Scottish guy who was done for insulting Captain Tom Moore. The guy's a gobshite. You know, like, there's no doubt about it. But if you want to make a fool of yourself, make a fool of yourself. Of course, they can't define what hate is. Hate is whatever you feel. And they can't define what a woman is. And if you can't define hate, and if you can't define a woman, you should not be in charge, right? Now, Ireland's hapless, utterly clueless, useless Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, has been trying to force this through. One of the protected characteristics in it is religion. And then in brackets, or the absence of religion. Now, I'm an atheist. So if, say, my religious friend David Quinn says to me, you're going to hell if you're not saved by Jesus, can I have him arrested? Because I'd probably do it just to annoy him. But the thing is, this powered through the first house in the Dáil, and all the politicians were basically saying, and this is the interesting bit, including Sinn Féin, that if you were against this, you were far right. Or you wanted to kill black people, or, you know, you wanted to go out and gay bash people, or you hated trans people. Then there was a bit of blowback, to a large part from some of the international attention, actually, because when I talk, or when other people like me talk, there's a whole cohort of people that, if the likes of myself and Myers said, you know, oxygen is really important, they would hold their breath until they pass out just to prove me wrong. You know, I mean, it's that sort of stupid kind of thing. But Sinn Féin, who were full square behind it, when it got to the Seanad, which is the upper house, our House of Lords, it was meant to just be rubber stamped, and it was meant to be passed in the last session of the Dáil. And the Seanad, bizarrely, for once, you know, a body which I think should be abolished, for once they actually did some good work, and it was Sinn Féin senators who were involved in blocking it. And all of a sudden, just as they have on the immigration issue, Sinn Féin did a full reverse ferret, because they held their finger up in the air, they saw which way the wind was blowing, and they went, okay, we're actually on the wrong side of the public on this one, so we better back down. So it's now they're talking about sending it back for yet another consultative process, which is official Ireland's way of saying it's probably not going to happen. Or if it does happen, it'll be in such a ridiculously watered down thing. But I was kind of, in a perverse masochistic way, I was nearly hoping they were going to bring it in, because I wanted to be the first person to be prosecuted. Because one of the elements of it was that even if you had something on your tablet or your phone, you could be done for 5 years if it was liable to display or incite hatred. Now, as it happens, I have a copy of the Turner Diaries on my tablet. That was the Timothy McVeigh's book that inspired him to do the Oklahoma bombings and stuff like that. And it's one of the most hilariously badly written books you'll ever read. But it is fascinating, in the same way that I read through Mein Kampf, same way that I read through Das Kapital. All of these books. So if a cop was to come into my house and they seize my digital electronic devices, yeah, take me to court. Like what we saw with J.K. Rowling with the Scottish police, when she went, yeah, okay, do me. Do me, come and do me. And the cops bravely ran away and went, oh, actually, no, she hasn't committed a crime. And I think the Irish politicians realised that this one wasn't really going to fly. Now, more naive and optimistic side would think that maybe this is just dead in the water. My more cynical side would think that maybe they're just bringing it back into a committee to dress it up in a way that won't terrify the natives quite as much as the original draft did. But there is, again, topsy-turvy land. We have the Liberals calling for censorship. We have journalists calling for censorship. The people who are calling for free expression are the Conservatives and apparently the far right. This is not the Ireland that I grew up in, but this isn't the Western society that any of us grew up in. At some point in the last decade, it had been brewing before that, but at some point in the last decade, everything just got flipped. And there was no great meeting, there was no great plan. It just kind of happened by osmosis. And now we have a situation where, again, as I said, the people who call themselves liberals have completely betrayed every liberal value that made liberalism great. And I consider myself to be an old school liberal. And do what you want to do, I don't care. As long as it's not harming anybody else, it's none of my business. Go on, fine, you know. That to me is the, you know, the distillation. Read what you want, listen to what you want. You know, don't incite hate, but don't incite, you know, basically be cool. Go about your day and mind your own business. Now the people who have taken on the modern mantle of liberalism, they're like the old school Catholics that I grew up with. They're in everybody's business. They're insatiable. And again, another similarity with the Catholics that I was talking about, no apology is ever enough. You can never apologize enough. You give them one apology, they want a more profuse apology. And until they break you, they're fighting a war of annihilation. One of the things I've said to other journalists, there was a time you put your hands up and you go, okay, listen, sorry about that, won't do it again. And everybody moves on. No, now that's seen in the same way that the bishops used to see it. Any form of apology is taken as a form of weakness. And they are the hunters, and you become the prey, and they go after their prey until they've killed their prey. There's no room for nuance. There's no room for making a genuine mistake. There's no room for making your point. If somebody misunderstands what you're saying and completely gets the wrong end of the stick, well then, as far as they're concerned, you're the one who's in the wrong. It's not that they're stupid, or it's not that they didn't understand the reference that you were making. We live in a post-factual world. We live in a pre-emotional world where basically emotions are far more important and knee-jerk reactions are far more important than bothersome things like facts. And the reason why I'm always proud to have something in Spiked, I mean, the likes of Spiked are doing God's work, because there is a resistance out there. But it does feel at times like it is a resistance movement that's really kind of fighting what often feels like a losing battle. But these things are cyclical. Sooner or later, we're going to have to re-enter the realms of common sense. Because one of the things that I find is that if this new era in which we live and toil, if it was as good as all its adherents and all its proponents are saying, people would be happier. I could get on board with this if young people were much happier than I was when I was their age. But instead, we have an explosion of mental health problems, an explosion in anxiety. Everybody's bloody miserable. So the new system isn't working for anybody. And that's demonstrably true, because you can see it in the levels of misery. And if you look at all the protests and stuff like that, you're not looking at happy people. And if you look at young people today, I mean, it seems that there's greater kudos in being a victim and being morose and being sad. And there's this sort of sanctification of victimhood. And kids are almost told that if there's nothing wrong with them, there's something wrong with them. You know, when I was a teenager, I grew up, I listened to the Smiths, I listened to R.E.M., I unsuccessfully chased girls, I played sport very badly. I bunked off school and I went to gigs. And it was a very simple life. I didn't spend my time gazing at my navel going, am I suffering from anxiety? Am I this? Am I that? Am I, you know? And we've become a medicalized generation where people are almost conditioned that feeling miserable is kind of cool. Jesus, we used to have a word for that. We used to call them goths and we used to slag them off. You know, I do think Ireland's going to blow at some stage. You can't keep on treating the people with the contempt that the authorities and the establishment have been treating them with. And it creates a vacuum, and into that vacuum come bad actors. And Ireland actually has a good, Ireland has a brilliant opportunity. We're a small rock on the edge of Europe in the Atlantic. And we can actually learn from the mistakes that have been made by the UK and that have been made by Sweden, Germany, France. We still have time to learn from those mistakes because we see it happening. You know, it's not some sort of paranoid racist theory. This is evidence that's right there in front of our eyes. We see it happening. And we know the steps that we can take. Will we take them? We'll be buggery. We will just continue to blindly go down the same line. And then when streets on Dublin are on fire, the establishment will look around and go, how did that happen? And I'll tell you how it happened. You didn't listen to the people. You didn't listen to the warnings. And you had the chance to avoid all the mistakes that our European neighbours and our British neighbours made, and yous were too arrogant and too full of hubris and too full of contempt for the working class who were raising these objections for years, and now you're reaping what you sow.
Ian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.